Hello, this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com, and on the line with us today is Michelle Cummings, who is the creator of Training Wheels, Inc., which is a leader in the portable adventure equipment industry. And Michelle has created a wide variety of facilitation, debriefing, and reviewing activities that have really collectively changed the way adventure-based educators of which many of the people listening to this recording are, change the way we work and approach this area of reviewing and debriefing and facilitation. Michelle's her undergraduate work is in psychology. She's got a master's in experiential education. And today what we're going to be doing is talking about one of the two books that she's written, one of them that we won't talk about today, but it's still very interesting, Bouldering Games for Kids, an educational guide for traverse walls. But today's topic is her book that she co-authored, A Teachable Moment, A Facilitator's Guide to Activities for Processing, Debriefing, Reviewing, and Reflection. Michelle, I'd like to welcome you to the call.
Thank you very much.
Well, so you wrote a 282-page book on this topic of processing, debriefing, reviewing, and reflection, what you collectively call a teachable moment. Start off with our listeners and help them understand, what is a teachable moment? What does it mean to when you say processing, debriefing, reviewing, reflection? What is that in an experiential program?
Well, a lot of times it is what happens after the activity. So some people process during an activity, they don't process at the end, but the whole processing piece comes from getting your participants or your students to make the connection between what they just did, whether it be in the classroom or in the corporate world, whatever they have just done in an adventure-based setting, whatever, and then take it to the next level. Okay, why is what we just did important? How can we make the connection between what happened right here back to what we do every day? And that's really the whole meat to what experiential education is all about, is to do the activities and then to talk about it and really get them to make that connection between what happened right here to what happens out there.
Okay, so tell me the flip side of that. Someone is out there leading an activity. Let's take a look at, first of all, what happens when a facilitator, a group leader, a teacher chooses not to do any kind of debriefing or processing?
A lot of times what can happen is you miss that teachable moment. You miss the things that they could have learned from, that, you know, whatever happened in the activity or in the classroom, if there's something really significant that happened there, it's appropriate to talk about it or get them to reflect on it in some way, so that way they learn from that, either a mistake or they learn from that success. Processing doesn't always have to be about, you know, what did we do wrong, what can we change. It's about what did we do really well that we need to continue doing as well. And that's really exciting.
Now, and you wrote this book with Jim Kane and Jennifer Stanchfield. Tell us about what caused you to write this book. And I've got to say that had I had a book like this, or had this book when I first started into this field, it would have helped me understand some things and approach my work differently, because, Michelle, I was one of those people who started off just leading the activity and scratching my head at the end thinking, I don't know exactly why we just did this other than there's got to be a good reason.
You know, so did I. I so wish a publication like this existed when I first got started as well. The book kind of came about when Jim Kane and Jennifer Stanchfield and I all met at a conference together, and Jennifer was leading a workshop on processing, and Jim and Jennifer and I all met after her workshop, and some magical things happened there. We just really started getting passionate about, okay, here were some really cool ideas and activities that that I had created, that Jim had created, and Jennifer had shown in her workshop, and we got really excited about, wow, there are so many different ways out there to process. And this is the hardest thing about what we do, is making that transfer piece. Because otherwise, all those games we play with rubber chickens and hula hoops and everything else are just a lot of fun games. But if we can attach meaning to them, then that makes it what we do that much more powerful for our participants.
Why is it hard? Why is this a stumbling block?
I think it's because there's an uncomfortableness about being open to whatever outcome happens.
Yes.
And and those uncomfortable silences that sometimes happen. I know for me early on, it was really hard for me just to sit there with nothing happening. Nobody was talking. It was like, oh my goodness, they hate this.
It's easier just to pull out another activity and say, here we go.
It is. Okay, move on. Let's go.
Right.
But I think also as you become a better facilitator, it's to be okay with those uncomfortable silences. Good things are happening there, even though it may feel uncomfortable to you. People are thinking, they're processing, they're really reflecting on what happened. It's not that they're bored with what we're doing. It's that, you know, maybe there's some great connections that are happening there and they need to process it before they can talk about it.
Talk a little bit more about that. The activity is over. And describe that situation where it's time to take a look at what happened and how we can apply it. And you've mentioned the silence piece a couple times. That's really something that does happen quite often. But you say that there's something happening in the silence there. And I suspect that many people like you are many people who are entering into this field and are pulling or using these experiential activities, they see a lot of action, and then there's a group circling up, and then you start talking about it, and then there's the silence.
Right.
Describe what's going on in your mind when you see that happening to a group.
Well, I think there's definitely, you can tell just by reading your participants, and as you facilitate more and more, you'll be able to get better at that. You'll be able to tell whether, okay, yeah, they really are bored, or hopefully the switch side is that, you know what, there are some good things happening. You can kind of tell by their nonverbal body language that they're giving off what's happening at that moment in your circle. And then another thing, too, is that sometimes if people aren't talking, if they choose not to be, you know, not to be vocal, sometimes that's okay, too. A lot of times I like to use any kind of, there's lots of prop-based processing tools out there, and I like to use the metaphoric models a lot of times, whether they be picture cards or we have a great activity called body parts, different things like that. But like with metaphoric cards, any type of picture that you put out there, if someone chooses a card, if you've asked them a question like, pick out a card here, a picture that best represents something that happened to you or a feeling that you had during this activity. And if somebody chooses a card, and even if they choose not to share why they chose that card with you, there's something happening there. They're making a connection between an experience that they had and a picture on that card. And that's processing. There's some things going on in the mind there that they're making a connection with, not just here in the moment, but they're kind of taking it beyond a little bit by attaching that metaphor to it. And that's pretty cool.
So tell me about how you handle the activity, which is very, you know, you present the activity. There's a certain number of props for the activity. You've probably seen the activity done a number of times, and you can pretty much guess how it's going to play out. And then there's the processing, which you know, you might know a question or two, but it seems like there's an open-ended quality to that, to a processing or a debriefing, where, and you said you don't necessarily know where it's going to go. What advice can you give to someone who's, you know, can read how to do the activity in a book or wherever, and then there's the part of, what happens if I ask this question, nothing happens, or the group brings up this, or you know, managing how the direction of the group, because you don't necessarily know what's going to happen, what the group is going to discuss.
Right. Well, a great way, just like you sequence your activities that you do throughout the day or your program, you also need to sequence your processing. You need to take your group, you know, some of your first open-ended questions that you need to ask are going to be things like, what just happened in this activity? You know, you need to take them through what happened in this experience, in this moment that they just had, so that way you can get them to eventually, well, why is this important? Why is, you know, Tom stepping up as a leader? why is that going to be important for what we do from here on out, you know, in this project that we're working on together in our classroom, things like that. So you take them through what happened, why is it important, and now what are we going to do with this information? How can this be helpful to us as a team or in the classroom beyond this activity that we just did? So sequencing is really a key part of processing. Because if you just jump in and say, okay, now how are we going to use this information to make us a better team? Well, you haven't really talked about what happened to get them to that point yet. So, and open-ended questions are really a key to processing as well. Answering questions that require more of a of an answer than just yes or no. Those would be considered closed-ended questions.
Right. A friend of mine loves these open-ended questions, and he told me a great one. He said, which is heavier, 1,000 pounds or a heavy heart? And the second one, I mean, that type of question gets you to think. There's no, like you said, it's not A or B. It's you've got to really think about your response. And oftentimes it seems like, Michelle, there's a good question. There is, you really have to dig deep, which is causes people to pause and think and ponder. So tell our listeners how some techniques that you use to help a group move through processing. I mean, you talk about sequencing processing questions. What are some of the other skills or techniques that are useful?
I like to mix up my processing to where it's not just we go and we sit in a circle and we talk about what just happened. That's
right.
Kind of a traditional sharing circle, and I still use those a lot, and I think they're very appropriate. But I try to mix up my processing to which the processing piece actually can become another activity for the group, but you're still talking about the previous activity that they just did. And it keeps your participants more engaged that way. They're interested in what this new thing that you've just shown them is, so they're going to be interested in talking about the process. So I like to mix up some prop-based processing tools with some non-prop-based processing tools and just really spice it up for your participants a little bit and make their learning fun.
Well, give us some examples of, I know that one of my favorites that you've created is something called the body part debrief,
right.
little bag. Can you describe that?
Absolutely. I created this activity when I was working with a group of fifth grade boys a number of years ago, and how I get a lot of my creativity for new activities is I go to toy stores or teacher supply stores, things like that, and I look at some other great things that have already been created out there, and then I tweak them to make it work for the groups that I'm working with. Well, I found these body part balls one time in a toy store, and so I bought them and took them out and kind of threw them into my group juggle bag. And after an activity that I did with these boys, one of the boys picked up the brain ball, and he said, "You know what I learned in that activity? I learned this ... And he said something completely profound about what he learned from that activity. I was like, "Wow, that was really an amazing connection there." So then I went on this quest to find every body part ball I possibly could.
And these balls look like—I mean, for our listeners, the ball—one ball looks like a brain. And one looks like a heart. What are some of the other parts?
There's an eyeball. There's a hand, a foot, a nose. and some of the metaphors that go with them are great, too. So, like, the nose could be, you know, something, if you stuck your nose in somebody else's business, or if you thought that performance really stunk and you wish you could do it over again.
Good.
Or the spine might be, you know, what's the backbone of your organization, or what took a lot of backbone or a lot of spine to do? The stomach ball might be what took guts to do or pushed you outside your comfort zone a little bit.
So paint a picture for the listeners here is that you have this small bag. These are all things that fit in your hand, these balls. And your walk us through how the debrief would go. You've done an activity, and you have this bag. What's going on? What happens next?
So how I like to do it personally is in my small group way that I do this is I depending on the number of people you have, if you have like 8 to 10 people, and also the age of your participants, with younger groups I put out limited number of parts, maybe 3 parts, so not to confuse them. But with adult populations, I'll put out, you know, maybe 7 or 8 parts out there to give them more of a variety to talk about. But I'll put the balls out to the center of the circle, And I'll ask the group to think about, you know, each part that's out there. And I actually front load the activity where I actually go through each part and give a sample metaphor on what they might represent. But that isn't the end-all, be-all. It could be, you know, they could make up whatever they want to. But that gives them an example. It also gives them time to think about which part they want to use and before you ask them to speak in front of the group. So then after I'm done setting up the activity, then I just kind of sit back and I say, I don't care who goes first. Just someone come forward and choose the part that you wish to speak on and tell us, you know, your connection between the experience and that part. And then put the part back, so that way if somebody else wants to use it, they can. And it's really an amazing, I've had more success with this activity than I have any other activity. And I don't know if it's the coolness factor of the body parts, but they really do create a safe environment in which for people to share. And I don't know if it's because you're talking through an object. The heart ball, I always get a lot of interesting responses to the heart ball, especially with adult populations where sometimes it's harder to share your feelings with your coworkers or other adults. I had one woman tell me one time that the only reason why she talked about her feelings was because I specifically said the heart ball might be representative of a feeling that you had today. And she said that it was her work environment was that uncomfortable and it was not okay to express her feelings, but because I said, I gave her permission to talk about her feelings. So, and she could kind of externalize them a little bit from herself because she was talking through the heart ball to her coworkers. It was pretty amazing.
I think that that is very interesting that someone uses holds on to this ball or whatever it is, whatever prop it is. Somehow that releases something in them or enables people to say and do things that they wouldn't normally do if you just sat there in a circle and talked about it.
Right. And the other cool thing about the body part is that most people have those parts, and so they understand what they do. So it's easy for them to make a connection between the metaphor and what just happened. So it's a pretty useful tool. I love it.
Now, you've worked with a wide range of people from therapeutic populations, corporate groups, school groups, train the trainer, all types of people. When you work with a group, do you see differences in how you approach or how other people successfully approach working on these teachable moments with groups? I mean, when you said you were working with fifth grade boys, do you see a lot of difference or tell me the differences that you see with working with a corporate group? Would you still, for example, use the body part debrief bag?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of my favorite ones to use with corporates, actually. Actually, just my favorite across the board. But, yeah, I've used this activity with as young as 3 years old, three-year-old participants. You definitely just have to change your language to make it fit whatever group you're working with. And then, you know, corporate groups, it's a really great one. And then I've used it even with senior citizens groups because sometimes those parts aren't working so well anymore, and it's just a great avenue for them to open up and share and talk about those things.
Do these props that you've developed and pulled together, they work? You'll use them, the same props, with all kinds of different groups, and you'll see what is similar that you see across the board. I understand that there's some language that you got to change, but what do you see similar across the board, no matter what the group?
Really, the metaphoric methods activities that we use, the body parts and picture cards, things like that. Those things are the easiest, I think, for people to make connections to, you know, no matter what age they are. They're also great for language. They're not language specific. So if you work with other groups that are bilingual or that don't speak English, then, you know, you can use these in any language. So did I answer your question?
Yeah, you did. Now tell me about doing some of these activities. You said, for example, the body part debrief bag would be good for 8 to 10 people. Tell me, I would consider that a small group working in. I know that you've worked with very large groups. Tell me kind of the graduation of, can you, for example, successfully debrief activities with very large groups?
Absolutely. You just have to change your mode of thinking around, you know, just having to sit down and sit in a circle and everybody has to hear what everybody says.
Mm-hmm.
You could definitely debrief with large groups, and we have a number of large group debrief activities in the book as well.
Can you share one or
absolutely.
One strategy?
Yeah, a great one is called Shuffle Left, Shuffle Right. And I actually did this with a group of 200 one time, and it worked fabulously. What you do is you have the group stand in one large circle. So for 200 people, that was a pretty big circle, but it still worked. And you just have people, they can either put their hands around each other's on the lower back of the people standing next to them, or they can hold hands, or they don't have to touch at all. They can just be standing kind of shoulder to shoulder in a tight circle. And the basic directions are you're going to start out as a facilitator giving the directions and say, okay, when I say go, we're all going to start shuffling left. And so everybody just kind of shuffles their feet to the left a little bit. Then when somebody has something that they want to say, then they're going to yell out, stop. And at that time, everybody stops. And then you have, you know, 10 to 30 seconds to say whatever it is you want to say. And then when you're finished, you'll say either go left or go right. And then the group will start shuffling whichever direction you've just told them to go. And then the next person that feels empowered to stop the group and say something, they yell out, stop. And they say what they want to, or they can bust out in song. They can, you know, however they feel that they want to, you know, close up their day and give a reflection on their day, then they stop, say what they want to say, or they could say thank you to someone, or they don't have to make it about themselves. They could make it about the group. And then when they're finished, go left, and the group starts shuffling left. Then when it starts shuffling, you get to the end and nobody else has anything left to say. As a facilitator, start a countdown from 10, 9, 8, and then the group knows that if they do still have something they want to share, they have about 10 seconds in which to say stop before it gets down to, you know, 1 and 0.
Right.
Down to 0, then the activity's done, and at that point, everybody had their moment in which they could have had the opportunity to say stop. And it's a really cool way to, you know, it's also a great active circle. So if you have participants that really have a hard time standing still, or if you're at the end of a really long, hard day, if you've been doing a lot of physical activities, it's a great one to keep people from, you know, still engaged in the process, even though they're getting tired and their brains have been working all day long. And so active circles are definitely a great way to help with that.
That's a great one. And would that one also work if you had a group of 200 and just say, okay, get in groups of 10, and they could all be working simultaneously, all these groups of 10 doing shuffle left and shuffle right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
This is a great one that can be participant-directed, and we talk about that a lot in the book. Of coming up with more participant-directed processing activities to where your participants are actually engaged in the process and have a little bit of control over it. And that, again, as a facilitator, sometimes that takes a lot to kind of give up that control a little bit and let them kind of take some ownership over the process. But they'll be so much more engaged, and they may even get a lot more out of it if they're the ones kind of helping or aiding in the process.
It's funny, this idea of control. There was a study done with classroom teachers, and one of their greatest fears, the top two fears, were public speaking, believe it or not, and losing control of the classroom.
Oh, yeah.
And now, public speaking, what was interesting was that the teachers didn't consider speaking in front of their classroom to their students, public speaking, but if they were asked to speak to a parent group or, you know, to address some kind of, you know, other group other than their students, they considered that public speaking, and they were fearful of that. So this idea of losing control is something that to be reckoned with, because do you see it? I mean, has that ever happened to you when you were working with a group that you felt like you were on the verge of losing control? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's definitely times where your group, you know, can go off on tangents, you know, in your processing. Like, all of a sudden they kind of get to one issue and then it just starts going, you know, you can tell that it's not going anywhere. It's like, oh my goodness, we're meandering off and, you know, this, it's some good stuff, but it's not really relevant to either this activity or what we're doing, and, you know, it's rambling, and that definitely happens. So recognizing that, one, is a skill, and then two, is being able to ring the group back in, you know, that can take some skill as well. But, you know, just posing another open-ended question, or even saying, you know, I feel like we're getting a little off track here, let's refocus a little bit, and, you know, this is still good stuff, but let's refocus a little bit and get back to this, and ask then another open-ended question that would be relevant to where you, you know, other things that you want the group to do.
2 years ago, I was asked to come in to work with a group of teachers who work with kind of an at-risk population of kids, and so the principal said, hey, I'd like you to come in and teach some team-building games that my teachers can use in the classroom. I said, great. It was a day-long retreat. We're at this beautiful outdoor center. After lunch, everything was going well. I did an activity, channels, or, it, you know, it's the one where the marbles are rolling down the tubes.
Uh-huh.
And that, Michelle, launched a... the next thing I know, there were some teachers crying about it, because what happened was that activity raised some issues for the group that they hadn't dealt with. That had nothing to do with my workshop. And I later found out that there was some significant challenges just going on among the staff and how they were treating each other, things that I never knew going in as the facilitator, you know, to teach some team-building games. And I had to quickly... you know, pull in some different debriefing and processing skills. And this is the part where, you know, moving into the unknown that
right.
I think scares some facilitators is what could come up and,
right.
and am I prepared?
Well, having some things in your bag of tricks, your facilitator bag of tricks, you know, are definitely helpful in situations like that. I would call something like that more of an intervention almost. And a lot of times processing is appropriate to happen in the middle of the activity and not necessarily at the end. If you see some really good things happening right in the middle,
right.
as long as you don't, you know, like totally kill some momentum of what they're doing, it's okay to stop and process in the center of the activity and talk about, okay, what's going on right here? And, you know, a tool that came to mind when you were saying that, when you have like unknown issues that all of a sudden come out of the blue that you didn't even know you were going to have to deal with today, some tools that I use, one is called the pocket processor, and they're a bunch of circular cards that have the yin and yang symbol on them.
Yes.
And they'll have examples of a continuum there. So one might be sacrificing quality for timeliness, and the other side of the card is sacrificing quality for timeliness. Or is that what I just said? And sacrificing timeliness for quality. So
right, right, the opposite, reverse.
Yeah, the reverse. So there's the deck of cards is, I think there's 56 decks of cards in the deck. And so what I do is I'll pick out the issues that I see relevant to whatever's happening in the group, and I'll put those cards down in front of the group and ask them to look over all the different issues that are out there in the center, and then come to consensus on the one issue that they think is the biggest issue going on within the group right then.
Hmm.
And by doing that, they have to process through all eight or so of the cards that you put out there to get to the consensus on the one issue. And then you can set some action plans and goals around that big issue. And we've touched on the other issues a little bit, but at least we know what is the big issue. And, you know, and this needs some our attention right now. So let's do this now.
Oh, that's a great example. Well, believe it or not, we're coming close to the end of our time together.
Oh,
and
with that.
And I'd like people to know how they can find out more, because we have just touched the surface of this. I know that you and I were recently in Texas, and you led an entire workshop based around just this book, a day-long workshop.
Right.
So
we offer the workshop, and we title it A Teachable Moment,
mm-hmm.
and we offer it in one-day format and also in a two-day format, because there's so much meat here. The book itself has over 130 different processing tools in it, so there's no way we're going to get to all 130 in even one day, in the one-day session. So we offer a two-day processing workshop as well. We also put out a newsletter once a month via email that people can sign up for on our website. And it also talks about, we do an activity of the month, a book of the month, and then a non-prop game of the month. That would be, sometimes it's relative to processing, and sometimes it's more of a problem-solving initiative, something like that.
Mm.
But then I just encourage people to go, you know, to seek out experiential conferences. There's some other great processing titles as well, in addition to ours, that I got a lot of value in learning from early on.
And you actually have a resource at the back of the book of different books that you recommend.
We do. There's probably two or three pages worth of other books that are great to just to look or check out at your library. And there's a couple books that I try to commit to rereading every year just because there's that much good stuff in them.
Mm.
And you can really, you know, you can really better yourself and make your participants' programs better by making yourself a better participant, or a participant and a processor.
Well, this book is great. The way you've laid it out, there's just a lot of information, great photographs, great examples, and just a wide variety of things that are take a little more time. Like you have some mask-making information in there and how to use that for getting at a teachable moment, and just all kinds of wonderful things. What is your website? Can you give our listeners your address?
Absolutely. It's www.training-wheels.com. Don't forget the dash. You'll get another site.
And your contact information, how do people reach you?
We have a 1-800 number, and it's 888-553-0147. We're located in Littleton, Colorado, just outside of Denver, but we travel all over the country to do programs. So if the Teachable Moment Workshop is something you want to have happen for your staff or at your program location, then we travel. Have bag, we'll travel. That's
and you also offer other workshops. What are they?
We do. We do some game workshops. We do. We have some facilitator workshops, the processing workshop. All that information is available on our website in greater detail than what I could explain here.
Yes.
And
the book, of course, is they can order right through the website.
They sure can.
Okay.
That, and we also have over 200 activities and books that are all experiential-based, hands-on learning activities. So go to the website and browse around and see if you find something that works for you. Or, you know, look at some of the stuff and get some ideas from it and use some of the stuff you currently have. That's okay, too. Look at some of the great ideas that are there and tweak some of the stuff you already have to make it work for yourself. Another feature about the book is that at the end of every activity, it tells you where to find it or how to make it.
Mm.
So if you're working on a budget, then it tells you how you can make the stuff on your own. You don't have to go out and buy it. You can definitely get creative on your own and come up with how to figure it out, how to make it on your own.
I love that. And the book is very detailed in that respect. Well, Michelle, you've been awesome. And this is a fantastic book. I recommend it highly to everyone listening to this recording. And encourage everyone to visit your website, which is, again, www.training-wheels.com. And check into what Michelle has to offer. Well, Michelle, thank you very much for your time today and for writing this book.
Thanks so much. I had a great time.
All right. Well, this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com signing off. Thanks for listening.